Good morning, everyone. My name's Peter Jones. I'm your chair for this session, and it's my privilege to introduce Tony Coleman, who will be presenting the presentation, International Developments in Prudential Regulation of Banks and Insurers. Tony is a director of Lonergan Edwards and Associates Limited. Tony is a corporate advisor and company director and a former president of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia. He was the Chief Risk Officer and Group Actuary of Insurance Australia Group for 8 years until 2008, and a Corporate Advisory Partner of PricewaterhouseCoopers for 15 years prior to joining IAG. His career has included both management roles leading teams, building significant businesses, and a diverse range of governance and advisory roles spanning business valuation, corporate finance, investment stewardship, risk management, and actuarial issues for clients in both the public and private sector. He also currently holds active roles working with both the International Accounting Standards Board and the International Actuarial Association, and is a director of the Australian Carbon Trust. He is also a member of the advisory boards of both the Macquarie University Business and Economics Faculty and the Australian National University's Climate Change Institute. Over the last 2 years, he has been involved in various international forums considering prudential regulatory reform consequent upon the global financial crisis. He leads a task force of the IAA on this subject during 2008-09 and presented on behalf of the IAA at various meetings, including the Joint Forum in Paris in 2009 and the International Association of Insurance Supervisors Financial Stability Committee in Basel in 2010. Would you please welcome Tony?
Thank you for that introduction, Peter. What I'm going to attempt to do in the next 25 or 30 minutes is a fairly high-level overview of some of the things that are happening around the world that I think would be of interest to us here. And then I think we'll open up for questions and discussions after that and perhaps talk about how this might affect things happening in Australia. I probably should just say at the outset too, this presentation is originally based, although it is a little different, to the one that I presented in Basel in February this year to the Financial Stability Committee of the International Association of Insurance Supervisors when I was representing the International Actuarial Association in putting some views forward. It has a fair bit of flavour from the International Actuarial Association in it. One of the key issues that people are concerned about at the moment in this environment is the whole issue of systemic risk and particularly changes in prudential regulation that should flow in various jurisdictions around the world as a result of the global financial crisis. And it's also fair to say this is a pretty controversial subject, and there are a wide range of views in a lot of different people about the subject. And so what you're watching here is an unfolding discussion, which will take at least another 6 to 12 months minimum to resolve itself. So regard this very much as a commentary on work in progress. That's basically a list of some of the things I thought I'd try and talk briefly about today. And starting with systemic risk. Now, this is actually quite an interesting area for the simple reason that it's an area that the central bankers in particular are focusing on pretty heavily and are talking about specific capital charges for systemic risk. That is, if you are a big enough institution, they will start actually levying a minimum capital requirement for the fact that you are a very big institution. That is one of the proposals. So the first question that probably needs to be asked is, well, what is systemic risk? How do we define it and how do we measure it? And there is a common definition which has been adopted by the three bodies mentioned there, the International Monetary Fund, the Financial Stability Board, and the Bank of International Settlements, which is shown on the screen. And it really boils down to A, size, B, lack of substitutability of the particular institution, and C, the degree to which that institution is considered to be interconnected with other institutions. And one of the issues that has come up very quickly in this discussion is that there are major insurance industry bodies around the world, particularly the Geneva Association, which I presume many of you would be familiar with. It's an association of 80 very large insurers around the world, which has formally taken a position with a fairly detailed documented report issued actually in February also in Basel this year, where they basically say, with a couple of slight qualifications, that systemic risk doesn't really apply to the insurance industry, or at the very least it's not an instigator of systemic risk, maybe a transmitter. They then obviously have the obvious qualification, if you're dealing in securities brackets like IAG, then this doesn't really apply, but we don't really think that's part of insurance. So they sort of slide around that particular issue that way. It would be fair to say that that met a fairly sceptical reception with the regulators when it was presented to them in Basel in February. But as the actuarial profession, we were also there basically saying, well, we don't actually agree with that. We actually think the insurance industry can be a source of systemic risk. And just very quickly, some of the examples why. Obviously, in certain situations, if you have typical capital adequacy regimes, as they are in many jurisdictions around the world, if you get into a situation where asset values are falling, you get to a point where you effectively start forcing insurers to liquidate assets in order to get to the point where they can meet their capital requirements. Of course, that is very nature becomes pro-cyclical, because as the selling pressure comes on from those institutions, it forces the market even lower and makes the problem worse. So this is a feature which has been identified as pro-cyclicality within the regulatory system. It's not just applicable to insurers. But some of you would recognise this as exactly what happened in the UK in particular in about 2003-04, where a lot of UK life insurers were pretty much caught out on exactly that issue. Some other examples of systemic risk insurance, obviously if you have a failure of a major reinsurer, that will impact a lot of other direct insurers fairly quickly. We've obviously seen what can happen when something like an AIG, which is primarily an insurance company, has a fairly major problem, shall we say, in a non-insurance business, particularly if that was not regulated by an insurance regulator, which of course was the case with that particular situation. For those of you with long enough memories, of course, there's the Lloyd's spiral in particular of the early 1990s, where effectively reinsurers were simply reinsuring with each other inside Lloyd's, so the risk was not really going outside Lloyd's at all, even though it looked like it was if you weren't looking across all the counter party exposures at that time. And interestingly, we believe it's also quite possible for the insurance industry to generate systemic risk where you have insurers essentially issuing minimum guarantees or investment return guarantees and creating asset liability mismatches. I'll take that as a relatively obvious statement in this audience. Hopefully that won't need a lot more explanation. There are also behavioural issues that have to be start to be thought about here. Very often people just don't think about, well, if everyone else starts to do the same as I am doing, am I just going to get trampled by the herd, effectively? And we still have the sort of thinking that if everyone else is doing it, it must be all right in terms of general business practice, probably typified by two outstanding quotations that are going to be long remembered, I think. The chief executive of Citicorp or Citibank basically saying, you know, immediately prior to the global financial crisis, as long as the music is playing, we've got to get up and dance, and we're still dancing. And of course, we saw what happened as a result of that. And from the insurance industry, you're really only as good as your dumbest competitor, meaning if someone else is going to seriously underprice a product and therefore make the market in that product, you, as somebody who thinks they might be taking too big a risk, have a problem because you won't be able to sell your product at the appropriate price. This, of course, is not a simple discussion. There are a lot of related issues, and I don't intend to go through all of these in detail, but just to say that once you start getting into this area, you need to be prepared to put some battle armour on, really, because there are so many other intersecting issues with it that are listed there, that you need to actually have some thinking done about what is your attitude to those and how do you argue your position through, particularly when you have a whole variety of other people generally with different views from, you know, regulators in different jurisdictions don't even agree with each other about a lot of this stuff, let alone the insurance industry, of course, who are on the other hand And generally speaking, politicians who are operating at the G20 and to a lesser extent at the Financial Stability Board level, they will generally take a different view again on some of these issues, which I'll come back to later. The behavioural risk is also really important. And I just, as a former CRO myself, I ask you to, or invite you just to consider this dilemma. Supposing you've been back on Wall Street and the chief risk officer of a major firm, and it doesn't, of course, just apply to the major money firms in Wall Street, it applies to all insurance businesses as well. But as an extreme example, if you had been back there in 2005 and 2006 and you had actually identified, as a few people did, that the housing market was probably starting to get a bit overheated and the subprime was becoming a problem, and you'd gone to management and said, we really have to start reducing our exposure here, we'll get out of this business. The problem was that they were making so much money out of that business that anyone who came to them with that recommendation, or a recommendation that said, at the very least, immunise our, use a hedging strategy to at least take our positions so that we won't be hurt if this thing reverses, would have lost a hell of a lot of money for that firm. And there's a limited tolerance, of course, in most management teams for losing money on a continuing basis for an extended period before the market finally does reverse. So it's not really a simple problem to solve, even if you did actually know and spot with accuracy and you were proved to be right eventually. You don't necessarily get the right outcome if you speak up and try to get some change. And so that is, of course, part of the behavioural problem in all firms, and that is one of the things that we need to actually start addressing, or build mechanisms which we'll start addressing, which I'll come back to a bit later, that start to try to mitigate that sort of thinking and behaviour, because until you do that, you won't really have a system that is genuinely robust. Now, very quickly, this is going back just slightly, but just to give you all a bit of an insight, back in late 2008, the G20, when it was really getting going, immediately following the global financial crisis, came up with a list of five key things that they felt were important to develop in financial regulation going forward, prudential regulation, I should say, going forward. We took the view at the International Actuarial Association that whilst that was fine, it was probably incomplete, and that there were some other things that were needed, which, if they're not done, probably the first five would be nice, but they probably wouldn't be all that effective. And that slide summarises the position we took at that time. I think it's fair to say that at the subsequent meeting of the G20 in early 2009, in April, in London, if I remember correctly, a lot of that thinking was actually then taken on board at the G20 level, because a few other people have been saying it as well, but we were very much in sync with a number of others saying to the G20, actually, you've got it about half right, but you haven't got it fully right. Of course, the G20 then created what's now called the Financial Stability Board, which essentially is comprised predominantly of central bankers, senior central bankers from around the world. And that body, in turn, whilst taking its orders, in a sense, from the G20, is really driving the behaviour now, in particular, of two other bodies, the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, which, of course, is a critical body in the world of banking regulation, and the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, which is increasingly becoming an important body in the international regulation of insurance. It's fair to say that the Basel Committee for Banking Supervision has got very much on the front foot, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a minute, seeking to create what some people are calling Basel III, which is sort of like the third generation of the original Basel framework from the late 80s. One of the most important things about the G20 activity, though, is that as a result of the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh late last year, the US actually for the first time agreed that they would actually sign up to getting their banks to comply with Basel, that is Basel II, which up until then they hadn't agreed to at all. So Basel II was there and operating for most banks, but not the American banks. And that's a pretty significant development. I will jump through some of these slides, otherwise I'm going to take a lot longer than 30 minutes, but this summarises the approach that we took at the time as the International Actuarial Association in advising people what we felt was needed. And so essentially saying there has been an over-reliance on monetary policy. We need other instruments. Now, that alone is somewhat controversial, I'd have to say, and I can come back in the discussion about explaining who's on what side about that in which countries to some extent if people are interested. The main problem, of course, was that if you look at that graph and you consider back in, say, September, October 2008, which is when the peak of the crisis really hit, if you're running monetary policy in the US, what you're trying to do, obviously, is provide relief and get interest rates to go down in order to, you know, effectively mitigate the worst of the crisis. What actually happened there, as you can see, is that if you look at the black line, interest rates went up, and they stayed up for at least 6 months compared to where they'd been previously. That's for a double A or better rated borrower. That's an investment rated risk. That's not common garden borrowers. What actually happened, of course, was that even though the official interest rates were being cut aggressively by the Fed in the US, the market was saying we've suddenly got a lot more risk here, and they were pricing very heavily the credit spreads for credit risk. The net effect was that the credit spread increases were bigger than the risk-free interest rate reductions, so the total interest rates to even very good borrowers were going up, which is the exact opposite of what you would have wanted to see if you were the Fed. So we would argue that there is actually quite a good case for other instruments to be brought into play in a situation like this, and indeed generally, the other instruments obviously being countercyclical capital requirements for banks and insurers. Which, you know, we'll talk a bit more about in a moment. The idea being you don't put all of your reliance essentially on one instrument, being interest rates, to try to control what's actually happening from time to time. So what are the Basel Committee actually doing at the moment? They're right in the middle of a very busy year for the Basel Committee. They're essentially put out proposals for comment as to some of the measures that they intend to take. I don't intend to try to go through all of them because it's a fairly large... it's a subject for probably an hour's presentation in itself. Essentially, though, they're right in the middle of trying to do the impact assessments now, and by the end of this year, they have a stated aim of basically trying to get agreement about what the new standards for banking regulation will be. Some of the provisions in them are pretty onerous at the moment, I might add. So, banks in Australia are certainly watching this space with great interest and indeed potentially trepidation. The other issue here, of course, is that the Basel Committee is by no means a unified body. It itself, you know, is the subject of a whole series of political, I suppose is probably the best word for it, discussions where different countries have different views about how certain things should be done. The only thing that probably is common is that everybody agrees banks in general around the world need more capital. And once again, I don't intend to go through all of these details just in the talk, but the general idea, firstly, is increased capital minimum capital requirements for most jurisdictions and introduce probably some form of countercyclical capital requirements, including... Well, the other thing that does need to be just discussed briefly is one of the key proposals is a leverage ratio. The leverage ratio for banking has not been determined as to what it would be, just having a proposal that there be a blanket leverage ratio, upper limit, if you like, on the gearing that a bank can undertake. This is obviously a reaction to the very high levels of gearing that many banks around the world have had, you know, pre-global financial crisis. Interestingly, a group of banks that would be quite negatively impacted if the leverage ratio is set too low would be the major Australian banks, simply because they actually have quite a large amount of home lending on their balance sheet, which carries a 50% risk weight. And, of course, a blanket leverage ratio, which doesn't discriminate by the kind of risk you're carrying on your balance sheet, would effectively mitigate heavily against those sorts of positions compared to a balance sheet which carries a lot of assets which are at higher risk weights, you know, 75 or 100%. So that is probably the one that is a particular concern at the moment to Australian banks. The other key proposals are just summarised in that slide for coming out of Basel or proposed Basel III, mainly around the requirements for liquidity. Now, liquidity is a really interesting thing to think about very briefly, particularly in light of what's been going on in Europe in the last couple of weeks. When is a government bond market really liquid? Obviously, Greece hasn't been all that liquid lately. How does a government bond market compare to, say, a robust bank debt market for liquidity from time to time, particularly in circumstances where some of the governments are guaranteeing the banks, as has been commonly the case in many jurisdictions around the world lately? This raises all sorts of interesting problems and issues. If you're sitting from the point of view of a banking regulator, trying to set up a set of rules that will be robust across a wide variety of market conditions. And I'll let you to contemplate just how some of that might play out. It also has some very interesting implications for accounting rules, which reach into insurance in particular, which we can talk a bit more about as well later on if necessary. Now, I've talked a bit about countercyclicality. The whole idea is here to try to change the system in such a way as to at least make it less pro-cyclical. Essentially, there was a real concern with some banks as we went into the global financial crisis. They actually kept making quite large payments of dividends or share buybacks or compensation, despite the fact that they could clearly see things were getting worse, because they were concerned that if they didn't do that or they started to pull back, cut back dividends, that would actually send a very negative message to the marketplace about that particular bank, which would then actually cause that bank to have even greater problems. So acting in their own self-interest, well, as they saw it, there was a very real risk they were actually making both their own position longer term and the system as a whole a lot weaker. So we have to try and come up with some proposals which essentially increase the amount of capital required in financial institutions when times are deemed to be good, and obviously then be in a position, which has two effects. It actually sends us dampened down asset price bubbles, obviously, if you're doing that, because it effectively constrains the price at which loans will be made into the system by banks in particular, but also to effectively have a capital buffer that's then available and can be released when things start to get a bit less prospective, shall we say, in capital markets or when the asset bubbles start to burst. The other major proposal, which is quite important from the actuarial profession's point of view, I would suggest coming out of Basel, is to change the way in which banks are required to set up their provisioning for loan losses. And essentially, for those of you not familiar with this, it could be best described at the moment as a retrospective system, backward-looking system where the loan effectively has to already have an event attached to it before it can effectively be moved and starting to have loan loss provisions put against it. An interest payment has been missed or some event has happened that has physically said, in this case, that loan is going bad or might go bad, as opposed to what would be much more like an insurance approach of saying, well, on average, we expect certain numbers and amounts to be lost in credit losses for loans of this kind. So you actually set up a reserve, which effectively is like an expected loss. Now, obviously, from an actuarial point of view, that's exactly how all general insurers are run and life insurers, as well for risk business. That's actuarially a concept we're very used to. It's effectively requiring the banking industry to start thinking about the sort of things that we call incurred but not reported losses or reserves and even unexpired risk. Those, of course, are concepts that conceptually are very familiar to actuaries, and indeed at the boundary between insurance and banking, which is often represented by mortgage insurers, the actual profession, certainly in Australia, is already doing quite a lot of work where the mortgage insurer is regulated and accounted as if it is an insurer, obviously. But, of course, what it's really insuring, the risk it's really writing, is a credit risk, which is exactly the same as a bank. But, of course, the accounting and the regulatory rules for the same risk that look rather different if they're on a bank balance sheet to if they're on an insurance balance sheet. And that, of course, is another area of, potential research, but also gives you a guidance, to at least where the regulators are trying to take the banking industry to make them much more prospective thinking, if I can put it that way, about where their futures are unfolding at any given time. In other words, they're supposed to be taking a prospective look at their risk, look at their risk profile, not a retrospective one. Just as an aside, the regulators are pushing, that is the BIS, are pushing the International Accounting Standards Board quite hard in this case to get the relevant accounting standard change, IAS 39. And whilst there is certainly some strong interest, I think, from the IASB in doing that, it would also be fair to say that there are some elements of the IASB that are not keen on the idea for a number of reasons we can go into later. And so that is by no means a done deal at this stage. Nevertheless, I think it's fair to say APRA and Australia are pretty attracted to this sort of idea. And interestingly, the big four major banks, broadly speaking, certainly at senior levels, do support the concept. There's a little bit of discussion about the detail of how it would be implemented, where I personally think there's quite an opportunity for the actuarial profession. I'm going to move on a bit quicker here. I've already talked about the general idea of countercyclical capital because I'm conscious I'm going to run out of time otherwise. The questions being asked and discussed really at the moment are these ones. Can it be done at all? Some people say it's all too hard, including, I might add, the Australian Reserve Bank at the moment anyway. If it is going to be done, who should be responsible for managing it in the Australian context? Obviously, APRA being one possibility, the Reserve Bank being the other. And if you are going to do it, just how would you go about it and what costs might you be imposing on the community by doing this and will it be worth it? Who will be covered by it? Well, in the Australian context, that would probably be banks and insurers in particular. What else do we think we need to think about if we were actually going to do this? Obviously, that's quite a long laundry list of questions. Just on the quickly on the subject of can it be done, that really boils down to can we identify asset bubbles as they're emerging. There is undoubtedly some research emerging now which basically says that the answer to that question is yes, and therefore I think those personally who are arguing that it can't be done because we can't see it happening as it emerges are probably on, you know, shall we say, the more difficult side of the argument. But just understand there is a fairly strong argument going on about that at the moment. Some people don't believe it can be done. If it can be done, well, what are the sort of indicators that you would need to understand it, measure it, monitor it? There's a bit of a list there of things that we think would be already available and sensible. And I probably should say at this stage, I'm conscious of the fact I'm going through some of these slides fairly quickly, but I'm sure the slides will be available on the website for anyone who wants to go back and look at some of the detail on these a little later. The next major issue to think about here, and another fairly major fundamental plank in which divides people in this debate, is let's assume we do want to do this. Everyone does seem to broadly agree that in concept it's not a bad idea. Well, not everybody, but the majority do. And it's certainly right up there in the Basel Committee's thinking. The next question is, do we do this in a discretionary way where the bank supervising body in each country effectively has a lot of discretion about how they would do this, how would they implement it, when would they change the rules, or when would they change their policy? The easiest way to think about this is to say if you go down that track, that's very much like what the discretion we now give to the Reserve Bank in exercising monetary policy. So essentially it becomes another tool of monetary policy is at one extreme of the spectrum. The other possibility is to say, oh, no, no, that's all too hard and it muddies the waters, and in some countries there isn't as nice clear delineation as there is in Australia between, you know, the central bank functions and the bank supervisory functions. We need something that's formula-based and doesn't leave a lot of discretion. One of the reasons that some people argue this is that the regulator themselves almost has to be protected and basically say, well, that's the international rule that's been agreed on a formulaic basis. You know, therefore, inevitably, when they make life harder by applying the rule to increase capital requirements in response to given changes in market circumstances, assuming there's a formula that drives that, then they basically have something that they can argue back when inevitably the industry affected screams that, you know, they're being unreasonable. They've also got something that they can argue to politicians at the other, in their local jurisdiction on the other side that basically says, well, that's the international rule, therefore we've applied it, as opposed to having to argue their way through without the support of something that is fairly concrete from that point of view. So there are pretty good arguments, actually, for implementing it either way, I think. It's not a clear-cut decision. And indeed, where the Basel Committee now seems to be going, and this is not official, but just based on just general discussions I'm aware of going on, is that they may well, say, give individual national jurisdictions a discretion whether or not they have a formula-based system or not. So in other words, there may be formulas, but you may not have to apply them, which is a rather interesting way of tackling it. Nevertheless, that's not a done deal either. That's just perhaps the consensus, the compromise that might come out of some of the discussions that are going on at the moment. Now, just to give you a very quick example, the sort of thing that we could talk about here, many of you in this room would be familiar with the concept of a resilience reserve in the Australian life insurance system at the present time. Interestingly, although it was never designed originally for this purpose, it is a good example of a countercyclical capital requirement. It does act in the right way. Basically, as markets go up, it requires more and more capital, and it allows the life company to release capital as markets are falling. So actually, there is actually an example, and it's a fairly rare example in the world, of right here in Australia, of this sort of thing having been in place for some time. Obviously, would need presumably some tweaking if you really wanted to get serious about having a countercyclical reserve, and of course it only applies to life insurers at the moment. The obvious possibility might be applied to non-life insurers, maybe even to, in some form, to banks. Some of the other issues just to think about very quickly in this debate. There's certainly plenty of evidence, and particularly in places like North America, where over the years, unless capital requirements, fairly stringent capital requirements, are imposed on the insurance industry, they tend to have a tendency to underprice, particularly minimum return and capital guarantees that they might provide with variable annuity products. One of the other issues, of course, is to think about, particularly with asset markets, on the one hand, with non-life insurance and pure risk life insurance or term insurance, you obviously have the law of large numbers always working for you if you're an insurer. It's not nearly as clear that the law of large numbers actually works very well in asset markets. And yet, of course, what a lot of life insurance contracts do is mix the two types of risk up in one contract. And whether or not we should be designing a prudential regulatory system which at least avoids falling to the trap of assuming the law of large numbers sort of works, or, if you like, mean reversion, works in asset markets is a pretty large and open question. I think is also a lot being discussed somewhat at the moment internationally. I'll take this as almost self-evident, hopefully. This is basically what the International Actuarial Association was arguing, that is, as part of additional things that did need to be done worldwide to the G20 and the FSB. That is, we definitely need a whole lot more enterprise risk management, I guess, at the individual company level. Things like financial condition reporting, things like independent sign-offs on liability and loan loss provisioning, things like lots of disclosure and mandatory reporting, particularly around risk. That really isn't a feature of typical regulation and financial reporting in many jurisdictions around the world. The Australian jurisdiction is actually one of the leading jurisdictions in a lot of this area. Some of this probably sounds familiar to you. That's because in many other countries around the world, these sorts of provisions simply aren't there. Well, we obviously believe they do improve the situation. A couple of very brief slides about one important part of the US reforms, which has had very little publicity, but is probably the most important part of them. I'm sure most of you will have seen over the last 4 or 5 months, there's been quite a lot in the newspapers about some of the reforms that are being discussed in the US. The first thing to say about the US is that it's actually really hard politically to get the kind of reforms that are needed. Just think about the insurance industry for the US for a moment. There's 50 states. I can't remember the exact number, but more than half of the insurance regulators in those 50 states are publicly elected. They are not appointments. They are elected officials. What, of course, that means is that they all need money from constituents in order to get themselves elected, and they are often seen as the first step on their way to a higher political office. Therefore, anybody who comes along and says, we're actually going to get rid of individual state regulators and have one national regulator immediately has a very large vested interest working against them and all of the people who have supported the individual state regulators to get them to where they are, if I can put it that way, makes the whole process of reform really tricky. If you magnify that into the banking industry and consider that I think there's about six different regulators with an active interest in the US banking industry, you begin to get a feel for how difficult this is. Nevertheless, buried inside some rather large reform bills, which I don't intend to go into in any great detail, is the proposal to create two new bodies in the US, one called the Office of Financial Research and the other called the Financial Stability Oversight Council. The general idea here is pretty simple. They actually feel that, believe it or not, they do need a body whose objective is to actually provide senior regulators with good data and analytical tools which would enable them to predict, prevent and contain future financial crises. Interestingly, this actually has bipartisan support too in the US political system. And so the idea is this office would be set up and then the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is essentially a committee of the heads of the major US regulatory agencies, both banking and insurance, would create an agenda which is informed by that information. It is recognised in the US that they don't actually have that information at the present time. Interestingly, the Federal Reserve Board, the central bank of the US, does not have a financial stability group within its operations. The Reserve Bank of Australia has something like 20, 25 people in a group called the Financial Stability Group. That's all they worry about within the Reserve Bank. Now, admittedly, it's a small part of the Reserve Bank's general operations, but nevertheless, it's there. It doesn't even have an equivalent in the US, which kind of tells you something. The mandate would be as set out on this slide, and of course the obvious concern is, depending on how it's set up, will it be genuinely independent enough to actually do the job properly, or will it wind up being constrained by either budget or political constraints that are put on the people, the way in which people are appointed to head it up. Nevertheless, assuming it did come up, it would be a major step forward in the US. Interestingly, though, one that hasn't had a lot of publicity. I've already mentioned quickly some of the things going on in the ISB. Sometimes, as somebody who's been now involved with the ISB's insurance accounting project, and I can see Grant smiling here too, this is one of those projects. I've been involved with this for 5 or 6 years now, and it's usually a case of, if you're lucky, two steps forward and one step back on a continuing basis. This was one of the steps, I think, forward. We do seem to have more or less locked in now one fundamental plank of having key building blocks that actuaries would actually, I think, recognise as being sensible for insurance in the way in which we set out to measure the insurance liabilities. It would be fair to say, though, that even since here, there's been further discussions this year, since December 2009, between the FASB and the ISB, which I think some would feel were not necessarily going in the right direction. So we can come back to that later if you like, but the point of this discussion is really to say and to highlight there are a number of different bodies around the world which have a part to play in trying to bring all of this together, and they are anything but in sync with each other. And so a large part of the problem is actually trying to get cut through and get agreement on some of these key issues between them. I'm not going to belabor that one. The point of that slide is that mandatory disclosures about risk are a really important part of any good system. It's still argued in Europe by some people that, you know, we shouldn't even, for example, if we're having risk margins in insurance, why on earth would we want to disclose separately the risk margin from the central estimate of the liability? You know, just only have to show the total number. You know, now that, to me, is the anathema of good risk management and good disclosure. And so we are arguing strongly that that shouldn't be the case. I'm not sure whether that will ever... And this, of course, is a current argument right now relevant to what the ISB will do with insurance accounting standards when they issue their exposure draft on their new standard in June, I think they're now talking about. Yes. Well, it continually slips, but we're getting closer to the end of June. Of course, in the EU, I haven't mentioned Solvency II yet, but some of you would be aware Solvency II is a major long-running project in the EU around how prudential regulation will work for the insurance industry in the EU. First, I'm just going to make a couple of very quick points about it. First problem is it still fundamentally depends on a value-at-risk measure for setting the capital required for an insurance operation. Unfortunately, of course, that is a pro-cyclical measure. So we have an immediate problem here in that we have an old-style thinking pro-cyclical system where we're trying to introduce counter-cyclical rules more generally for financial institutions. That has been exercising quite a lot of minds in Europe, and I don't think there's actually a very good solution yet on the horizon. The other major thing going on with Solvency II, as some of you would be aware, is that basically just before the crisis, the quantitative impact statement, or QIS number 4, was completed. And if you've looked generally at that particular statement and compared it with, say, the Australian capital requirements, if you were a regulator or indeed perhaps an actuary, you'd be a bit worried that maybe that was a fairly undercooked standard about to emerge. As luck would have it, of course, the global financial crisis descended and the regulators suddenly thought, gee, maybe QIS 4 has been parameterised at a rather low level, and maybe we've been a bit generous with all these depreciation allowances. So QIS 5 was implemented. QIS 5 is now, the results are now known. They are much more stringent and strenuous on the companies in terms of capital requirements. And so now the big debate is, we have QIS 4 at one end of the spectrum, QIS 5 at the other end of the spectrum, and, of course, you can pretty much predict who's arguing what. The debate will probably settle somewhere between the two, but where, I think, is still not at all clear. So there's a fairly wide range of potential outcomes from that alone. Oh, and the other thing that's happening is this strong push now to defer the start of Solvency II by at least a year. I'm conscious of time, so I'll keep moving. I think, in general terms, we do actually have a bit of a shared vision on the way forward, and certainly the need for greater capital adequacy in major financial institutions is amongst that. Trying to get unified view on global accounting standards, which will support that, is clearly necessary. And while some progress is being made, it's pretty tortuous. Clearly, we are now in a phase where governments are trying to reduce their guarantees of banks. And, in fact, of course, in some countries, particularly in Europe, we're discovering that actually the governments are the problem, not the banks. And so we're probably in for a fairly long, drawn-out recovery period here, which is going to have quite a lot of bumps in the road. And although I've said at the bottom of the point there, dangers inherent in reform fatigue as the crisis fades, whilst that's probably true in Australia to a limited extent, it's definitely not really true offshore as we continue to get these continuing shocks in the system. So in conclusion, there's no doubt that systemic risk is prevalent out there, and we certainly need new prudential arrangements, which are probably going to have to be in some form or other counter-cyclical to start mitigating those problems. And meaningful disclosure and the use of standards will be key in trying to increase the stability, reliability and consistency and comparability of the way in which all of those prudential standards emerge over the next 1 to 2 years in the international system. So I might just leave my prepared comments there, I think, and be happy to open it up for questions and discussion.
Okay, thank you, Tony. Just before we do, I just want to reinforce that these sessions are being taped or recorded. That being the case, we do have a roaming mic, and I request that you mention your name, state your name, and speak clearly in the mic so that we can capture either those questions directly for Tony or any comments generally that you'd like to make on his presentation. And we have about 10 to 12 minutes to cover this off.
Andrew Wakeling. Thanks, Tony. Could you talk just a little about the fundamental entity, the subsidiary or the group? One of the frustrations for a number of us in subsidiaries was the fact that something like AIG or Allianz is made up of hundreds of insurance companies, all with their own actuaries and their boards. Very few of them had any exposure to the sorts of assets that were causing problems. And yet we have groups taking the attitude that they're running one group and requirements to send reports and all sorts of things. Where has the concept of limited liability gone? this fundamental protection where we actually put the line around and we say, okay, this company has shareholders and it has a board and it has an actuary, and that's the prime unit of corporate governance, not the group.
A bit hard to know where to start answering that question. Let me make a couple of observations. Part of the problem is that many large financial institutions have outgrown national regulators, so that there isn't really one international regulator as such who can directly apply the sort of measures that a national regulator can apply to a group that's just inside their own territory. And so you're now beginning to see the creation of colleges of regulators, which will try to start to address that and increase the communication at the international level between the existing national regulators. The problem, of course, is that even those colleges won't have any real enforcement power. They're still going to have to rely on the individual national regulators. And there's already been a lot of discussion, I'm sure some of you in this room would be aware of it, within the Solvency II framework, about formally moving within the EU alone to proper group regulation, so that the idea was that for every identified group that operates across borders inside the EU, there would be a single lead regulator, which is one of the existing national regulators, identified as the regulator for that group, which would have, if I can put it this way, fairly, not final say, but a very strong say in what actually happened to that body at a group level. Now, what basically happened was that a very large number of EU members, the smaller countries in particular, soon worked out that what that really meant was that effectively financial regulation or prudential regulation of anything that mattered in the EU was going to be devolved into the hands of probably the English, the Germans, and maybe a few French and Dutch. And so if you're sitting in Poland, Hungary, Italy, etc., you were basically going to get relegated to pretty much a, you know, not relevant status. Unfortunately, that's a pretty tough thing for, you know, if you're sitting in one of those smaller countries to accept that you're about to hand over control of prudential regulation of any financial institution in your country to somebody outside your country. So politically that didn't fly at all, and the end result was that after a lot of discussion, the whole group regulation part of Solvency II was basically thrown out. So that in microcosm within Europe is a good example of what we're now trying to do internationally, because, of course, once you go to the international level, it's the same problem, but you multiply it by about 20 or 30 times. You really, you know, in some jurisdictions, obviously, we haven't even got to the happy situation we have in Australia, where at least we have one regulator that covers all banks and all insurers and super funds. You know, and interestingly, Canada is much the same. And also, interestingly, of course, Canada and Australia are probably the two countries, developed countries, that survived the global financial crisis probably the best. And the fact that they're regulated that way is perhaps not a fluke, if I can put it that way. Interestingly, as I'm sure many of you would know in this room, APRA right now has got a discussion paper out there on what's called Level 3 consolidation, which is exactly what we're talking about, and which they do seem fairly determined to eventually push through, although they are going to run into a little bit of political opposition, which for the first time will mean that they are genuinely looking at all financial groups in Australia, including their offshore operations, and treating them for regulatory purposes as one group. So, you know, there's about a dozen major institutions in Australia which are going to find themselves probably within 12 to 18 months with those rules applying to them. I think you will find that APRA is just about, if not the only, it's one of the very few regulators worldwide who actually is beginning the process of imposing rules like that. Canada does it to some of its jurisdictions and probably will get there eventually with some of its others. Switzerland is probably likely to go down a similar track. They are about the only ones I can think of off the top of my head that do. And undoubtedly, this has been and will continue to be a major cause of dramas. I mean, you only have to look at what happened at IAG. It's the perfect example. But there have been others not unlike it. So that's a fairly long-winded answer to your question. There's no doubt an ideal out there. The politics of getting to that ideal are really tricky. It's not unlike the problem that emerged in Copenhagen on climate change, I might add.
Yeah.
There are similarities.
Tony, Kent Griffin, just wanted to come back to your point on discretion with the regulator. You touched on the tension that usually exists within a company when you've got some warning signs about bubbles, etc. And to the extent you hand that discretion for capital to a regulator, you're basically handing the discretion to put the brakes on. How do you manage the culture or the approach within the regulator in terms of applying that? Because obviously they're driven very differently. They're going to tend to be biased towards taking a conservative approach because if they get the situation wrong, there's no downside for them. If they if they've over-regulated, if they've under-regulated, they're very exposed, and you've seen that in Australia with a number of failures over the last decade and how it's been reacted to.
Yeah, it's a good question. There's an extra part of that question too, which needs to be talked about. And I'm not talking about Australia here, but there are a number of central banks around the world who still have banking supervision as part of their mandate. The really interesting thing about that is if you look at invariably the culture of those organisations, banking supervision is basically the place where people are sent when they aren't going to be part of the main game in monetary policy and running, you know, the institution going forward or the country going forward. So it's very much seen as the poor cousin within their cultures, which has all sorts of unfortunate consequences when you start thinking about where that takes you. So you're absolutely right. I mean, the only real constraint ultimately on a regulator like an APRA in Australia is obviously the political process, where if they go too conservative, sooner or later complaints will be made to the government about, you know, this is unreasonable, it's having all sorts of cost imposts, you know, where opportunities are being constrained, et cetera, et cetera. And then it's really just a political debate about who wins, you know, and what the risk tolerance at the political level basically becomes. And that's really the only constraint. But it's a fair question and a reasonable one. But I guess the point I'm making is the cultures in the regulators are rather different around the world. You know, some have a very legalistic view of the world and almost act like a policeman, you know, very detail-focused. Others, and I think APRA is probably in this category, are much more principles-based and actually try to understand what's really going on inside the business a bit more and act accordingly. Whereas that's not always the case. You know, you shouldn't assume just because APRA acts that way in Australia, it's uniformly replicated in other parts of the world. It ain't.
We've had the five-minute bell, so we'll just make it one more very quick question, if we may.
Thanks, Tony. Anthony Asher, you didn't mention living wills, which I thought were one of the most significant possibilities, particularly because companies can do something about it, you know, now without regulation, is to just make plans for every potential disaster.
Yeah, that's a good question. Just so I presume most people are aware of this, it's particularly an issue that's come out of the UK, effectively a requirement on major too-big-to-fail and inverted commas institutions, which effectively asks them to document how they're going to wind themselves up if they get into trouble. And the point actually about this is exactly addressing the point Andrew Wakeling asked about earlier. It is a mechanism that colleges of regulators can use and agree on in advance about how things would happen for a particular institution. And so I do think there is a role in that sense, because it actually makes it a lot easier to negotiate. So we say in theory before the event, and then somebody says, OK, now we really are going to apply that rule because that's what we said we're going to do, as opposed to find themselves with a crisis on their hands and then the negotiations start. So I think it is an improvement in that sense, and so, you know, I don't think there's a role for them. The difficulty, of course, is getting them to, you know, be seriously implemented, seriously updated at least once a year, and the situation emerging down the track as governments change, witness, you know, what's happened recently in the UK, and it's, you know, the new government in the UK has proposals to change the way the FSA works. You get into a situation where somebody can easily say, when the crisis actually does hit, oh, well, you know, that might have been the plan over there, but, you know, we've really got the crisis now, we're going to change the rules again. So whether or not the living wills would really be enforced when it really mattered is the big open question. nevertheless, I personally would take the view they're worth having, and yeah, at least it sort of sets a bit of a line in the sand, and more importantly, probably sets a line in the sand when big fights break out between the interests of major national jurisdictions and national regulators, who obviously, when a crisis like IAG hits, the first thing they worry about is how this is going to affect me. To hell with that bit over in London that's just gone belly up. And that's the real tension, of course, that you do get into.
You, Tony, you've given us a very informative, wide-ranging challenging presentation. On behalf of everyone in the room and the Institute of Actuaries, I'd like to thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.